We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
It's 7 minutes after 1 o'clock, and this is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, AM 580, FM 90.9, HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Tom Rogers, in for Celeste Quinn, and as we do about once every month, we leave the field open for computer questions. It's the monthly Computers and You program on the Afternoon Magazine. And with us, as always, is Peter Kimball, who's the lead faculty trainer at the Center for Teaching Excellence on the U of I campus. And thanks for stopping by again, Peter.
It's always good to be here.
Peter is the guy who helps train the smart people on the U of I campus on how to use computers and what to expect from them. And he can answer your questions as well. The numbers are 333-9455 and in the outside the local calling area, 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL with your questions for Peter Kimball and Computers and You. And what kinds of things are we talking about when you know we're setting up for a new academic year here on campus? And what are some of the main questions that get asked of you as people come in and either get things started or continue their journey through computers as the school year begins?
Well, unfortunately, one of the main questions is the same that it's been year after year, along the order of, why isn't my computer working as well as it did when I first got it? And the answer is also, unfortunately, frequently that you've been clicking in dangerous places and downloading software that is doing things that you really would rather not have it do. And so it all comes down to security and being an intelligent user of the web, not believing any little pop-up box that says, you need to click here so we can protect your machine, or download this free screensaver. That's one of the most risky things that people do.
Well, a lot of people think, you know, we're pretty savvy about stuff like that, and we don't deal with the obvious things. But there are a lot of things out there that aren't so obvious, too, I guess.
There are a lot of things, and frequently searches that people are doing fairly legitimately are going to lead them to, if they're not careful, to websites that are loaded with malicious software that are just looking to try to take over various functions of your machine, including all the way up to generating spam email for others, becoming part of what's called a botnet.
Mm-hmm.
And even trying to capture banking passwords and such. One of the most dangerous, riskiest, I guess we would say, search terms any place, according to a study done by, I'm not finding the name of it, but a recent study published a little bit earlier this summer, is the search term lyrics. As
so you,
in
you just
want to see lyrics. And, well, the problem is when you type in lyrics, you get a whole set of websites, and 5 of the top 10 search results are found to be loaded with malicious software.
No kidding.
So you have to be careful where you go. You're safe going to places like, well, of course, if you're downloading the music, iTunes and other such places, but a lot of people who download it want to get the lyrics.
And so they go to Google or whatever, they find the top
few. They type lyrics and
they go to lyricsforsongs.net or something like that. It could be just some site that somebody had picked.
And comparisons and studies. And, of course, it's dynamic. It's going to be changing all the time. But lyrics is one of the most risky terms. Screensaver, 4 out of 10 websites that will be returned in the typical in their survey period that are listed when you type in screensavers will be loaded with malicious software.
And they're not obvious when you...
They look very legitimate. Mm-hmm. Just like a number of people have been in the past fooled by look-alike bank sites that try to trick them into revealing their password and such. So you just have to be a little bit careful. A well-protected machine with virus protection that is updated every day, as most of the high-quality ones do,
right,
is essential and will protect you from a lot of that. But you still have to be careful on your own, too.
And you still have to make sure that that antivirus software is being updated every day because
that's right.
You think it's going on in the background, and you, I guess you keep have to having to keep checking that.
Well, and we'll talk perhaps a little bit later, depending on the call volume, about some of the issues for Mac users as well, who have so far gotten off lightly because not much software is written out there to take advantage of Macs. But there are some issues there as well. If you have software, antivirus software, you can check and see if it has updated recently. Make sure that it's not something that came with the machine and the subscription expired and you're sitting there with really old virus protection that's not going to protect against anything that came out since the last update.
Now, there is free virus software out there.
There is free. There is also virus software that pretends to be virus software but is not frequently triggered by the little pop-up messages that you get as a result of visiting some of these malicious websites that you don't know are malicious to start with. You don't have to be looking at the seamier side of the net to find these things. They can be very upstanding-looking websites, but you all of a sudden get a little pop-up that says something like, virus detected on your machine. Your data, your files are in danger. Click here to download the, you know, XYZ virus protection software. And in many cases, those spontaneous pop-ups are going to download something that is not a virus protection software package at all. It is instead going to infect your machine.
Well, the Internet's become sort of the backbone of our business economic system, but there's still a lot of Wild West out there.
There certainly is.
1-800-222-9455 or 333-9455 for your questions on computers with Peter Kimball. And he'll be happy to answer those questions. We have one that's already come in this afternoon on line one, so let's go to it. Good afternoon, line one.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, you are on.
Okay, I have a couple of things. I was listening about your the danger of going to websites with lyrics, which I do all the time.
I do, too, to tell you the truth.
Well,
it kind of surprised me.
And the danger is not that a website that's going to give you lyrics is going to be dangerous in and of itself, but that has become such a popular search term that a lot of the writers of malicious software have created sort of decoy websites and used various tricks to get them listed high on a search. So if you do type lyrics, or if you've got your favorite website, it should be just fine. But the problem is if you type lyrics in a Google or a Bing search or someplace of that sort, the top listed sites, not all of them are going to be legitimate. So you just have to be careful what you click on.
So if you go to one of those sites, then it's too late?
Well, it can be too late if your computer system is not fully updated and fully patched with all the latest software updates and security releases and such. Those are essentially called drive-by websites, and yes, they will, as part of your loading the page, probe your system and see if it has any weaknesses that it can immediately download the software. More risky than that, and much more common, is when you were prompted to download something. Oh, we need to use a new compressor or a decompressor or something to be able to play this music. Click here to download it, or click here for this great new screensaver that will act as a super search engine as well. That's what you need to be really careful about.
Yeah, that I never do. I know better than to do that.
But. Good.
Okay, so my other question, my original question was, I have a CD drive and a DVD drive, both. And they act kind of strange. Sometimes I used to play CDs in the top one, but I can also play DVDs in the top one. And sometimes DVDs work in the top one, but not the bottom one, which is the DVD drive, technically. You know, or they'll work in the upper drive, and they'll be black and white, and I'll have to put it in the bottom drive to come in color. And it's just a weird setup. But that, my main question is really I'm having problems with the player. Both the CD player and the DVD player, similar kind of problems. I'll put in a CD, and the beginning song will always start to skip. I'll hear it like in a skippy fashion when I play it. Then I have a player in iTunes that I can download, you know, CDs from. When I play it back off the player after having downloaded it, it sounds fine. There's no skipping on the first song. And a similar thing happens with DVDs where watching a thing about the Historic Beast with my son, and you know it's divided up into episodes, and then about the same point in every episode, it'll start to skip at the same chronological point in every episode. It's just an odd thing. I don't know whether to think there must be a problem with the software. It seems odd that there would be a problem with the player if it's skipping in the same spot, for every episode or for every movie. And it's also skipping in the other. It's also skipping in the CD drive.
Uh-huh.
You see what I'm saying? I'm having a hard time understanding what could be the problem.
Well, there are a number of problems. The skipping can be done due to a software driver that needs to be updated. So that would be the first thing. Are you running on a Windows machine or a Macintosh?
The DVD program I use is InterVideo.
Okay. You'll want to check, because sometimes updates to software, the operating system software, security patches, can have interactions with the little bits of software called driver software that actually control the CD or the DVD player, and those need to be updated periodically as well. So
that happens automatically on my machine.
It should, but sometimes some of the hardware, the general software updates happen, but sometimes the hardware drivers, the software that comes from the company that produced the actual CD drive or the DVD drive may be a problem. So that's one of the things. I'm just looking to see on the web about CD players and skipping. If you'll actually check on a Google search or something just for CD player skips, I've got about 4 million hits on that. And that's probably relatively safe. It's not like typing lyrics and, just clicking on them, somewhat tongue-in-cheek there. The CD driver is certainly one of the things. How old is the machine? Has it been quite some time since you've had these CD drives and DVD drives in use?
No, not that long. I've had it about a year, this one. Maybe not even.
Well, so it shouldn't be. Occasionally, I've seen a couple of CD players in which just using a cleaning process, they make special CD cleaning processes that can clean the lens. But that's not as common a problem. I would first check to make sure that there is no issue in terms of the software drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing I would probably do would be to take a look at some of the solutions posted under a search for things like CD skips and see which one matches your experience most closely. A lot of them are finding that it skips on all CDs, whether it's new or an older CD.
Yeah, that's what's happening.
Which pretty much tells you that it is either a software issue with the driver, and it's also possible that other software you've installed has preempted the priority settings, and so when the computer is doing something else, it pulls cycles away from the CD driver software, causing it to skip. And there are various suggested remedies for that as well. You can take a look at the processes that are running and see how much CPU time they're using. So many of those approaches to try to figure out what's going on, you'll find under that just a search for CD player skipping.
Okay. So do you think I should check for updates to InterVideo WinDVD?
I would certainly check for that, yes. That sometimes can fix everything very quickly. Is there any particular time at which it's probably too long in the past now, but any particular time at which you noticed all of a sudden this started happening?
Well, it's been happening for a couple weeks.
At that time, was there any other software you had installed?
No, I don't know.
Or any updates that you had performed? Because that's another possible idea to look at.
Well, updates. Sometimes I get updates from Apple or, Adobe or...
Well, there can be some interactions. It's probably extreme, but if you're on Windows, you can also use the restore feature to restore the system to the way it was. If it was fairly recently that you started noticing this, like just a couple of weeks ago, you could restore back to that point and see if that takes care of it, in which case you know that it was something that was done with the system or the software.
Okay.
The downside is that you will, of course, lose any other system updates and have to reapply them.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Okay, well, good luck with that.
Much.
Hope that helped answer your question, and thanks for joining us this afternoon. Numbers again, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 for Peter Kimball. And we're asking for your computer questions on our Computers and You portion of the afternoon magazine. Let's go on to a caller on line two. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, line two.
Hi. I have a couple questions. First one, my wife has an older laptop, about a five-year-old PC, Dell type, you know, PC. And it's running XP, ran great for a while, but after, you know, five or so years, it's really sluggish. And we've tried, you know, keeping up with, you know, deleting unused programs and things like that, but it's just really still acting sluggish. So it's kind of a replacement question. Wait for Windows 7 or Vista, or what would you recommend on that?
So you're thinking about replacing the entire laptop and not trying to restore it to better.
Yeah, now, you know, we may have, you know, our daughter may wind up using it. We'll delete a bunch of software and stuff that's on it. But yeah, the question is more for looking for a new machine.
Well, Microsoft is about to release Windows 7. In fact, it might have reached the point that with any of the major manufacturers, in fact, it has, I think, with all the manufacturers now, if you purchase a machine, even though it's not the official ship date yet for Windows 7, it'll come with Windows Vista, and they will upgrade you free to Windows 7 from Vista at such time as officially shipping. So you can check that out at Dell or HP or any of the other sites.
Oh, are there any gotchas with that process? I kind of hate the idea of replacing an operating system, updating an operating system.
Well, it's never convenient, but my experience in the past has been that they send you a fairly, you know, the update diskette, and it's reportedly going to be even smoother from Vista to 7, because Windows 7 really is a new, improved what Vista should have been in the first place, according to many people. So you're not going to have to wait long. Just within the next month or so, Windows 7 will be shipping. You can check the various dates. In fact, if you order a machine, you might even be able to specify, if you're doing it, Dell or HP, to name two of the larger companies, you might be able to even specify that you want it to ship when it can ship with Win 7. As far as giving the other machine, the Dell laptop, to your daughter or whomever, you'll get it back to, since you're going to be clearing everything out, rather than just deleting the files, assuming you've still got the old Windows XP installation disks, you'll restore it to like new condition, for 5 years ago, by simply completely reformatting and rebuilding the entire operating system. That will require that you then spend a fair amount of time downloading all the updates since your Windows XP CD was created. But it will clear out all of the old clutter much more effectively than any possible combination of deleting files and software could ever do.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I've been through that process before.
Yeah.
A better way to go. Second question, kind of related to the first one, is on any of our machines, I'm always noticing that the number of processes running is just increasing all the time, and mine tends to load up with 87 or 88 processes, and some of which are things in the background that I probably would want there, but a lot of them, when I look at them, I'm not sure what's running. I can look and see which ones are hogging resources sometimes, but a lot of them are things that, you know, I really don't want them to run, go to meeting, things like that. I use them occasionally, you know, five times a year, but I don't need them in there running in the background ready to go. How do I go in and delete processes and things that are occurring during my boot and startup that I really know that I don't want?
And this is, again, on a Windows XP.
Yes.
System. There are a couple of levels at which you can do that. Windows XP actually comes with a tool that can allow you to manage most common startup programs. It's called msconfig.exe. You can just go to the start menu, run, and type command. I believe you would type command, or maybe just type directly msconfig. MS as in Microsoft, config, CONFIG, and that will give you a listing of all of the various processes that are published that publish their own information, and you can say, yes, I would like this one to start. I don't want this to start. That's not going to list absolutely everything, but if you go to, and again, do a search for things like startup processes or for a particular process, if you don't know what this thing is, you can type its name and see what it's part of, and it could be a process that's starting up, as you say, for things that you're not even using anymore. But there
I've done that a few times, but to go through, you know, 80-some of them.
Right. Well, start.
Them, you don't really know what they're doing, but a lot of times they are, and you know, it's a piece of Windows.
Right. Because you definitely cannot come along and just delete everything, because some of it is required for Windows to run. But try, if you haven't yet tried msconfig.exe, that's a very convenient way of just filling in checkboxes and clicking whether you want it to start up or not start up, and you can clear up a lot of things that way.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Quite welcome.
All right. Thanks for your call. And from a totally selfish point of view, I'm in about the same situation with an older laptop, which I don't want to get rid of. And any, you know, anything short of going out and buying a new one or wiping out and reinstalling the operating system. Talking about trying to get rid of some of those startup programs is one idea. What other things can you do to try to speed up the speed? Defragmenting still work in this case?
Defragmenting can work. There are several places that the system can slow down. One is that can make a major difference. Programs have gotten a lot larger now. Right. So assuming that you don't have a lot of extra startup programs going on for, you know, two or three different kinds of messaging programs, of which you only use one. Or in one case, I saw that somebody had actually left installed two different antivirus programs, which slowed things down tremendously. You must have an antivirus program to be safe, but you really don't want two because they just get in each other's way. And the short of making sure that you don't have that you've done the malicious software and the adware detection right. and gotten rid of that, one of the most effective things you can do if you're relatively fortunate is to be able to just increase the amount of system RAM memory, because a lot of older machines may only have 512K of RAM. And if it's affordable, sometimes it's more expensive for a laptop than you would like, just taking it up to 1 gigabyte or even a little bit more, if the system will hold it, it can make an incredible difference. And that's one of the major reasons for slowdowns.
But check your specs and make sure that that computer can handle.
And for Windows machines, there's a very good site that a lot of people around campus use that will actually ask your permission to download a little inspection program and then tell you, oh, you've got four slots in this machine and two of them are filled or whatnot, and it's simply going to crucial, as in it's crucial that you do this.com.
All right. That's some of the advice we're getting from Peter Kimball at the Center for Teaching Excellence on the U of I campus, and he'll answer your computer questions too if you call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. It's the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers, and let's go to a caller on line one. Good afternoon, line one.
Hello. I'm running Vista on a fairly new computer that has 4 gigs of memory, and I just love the media center. You know, I've been recording television shows, and I want to get them off my computer's memory, and I really hate to burn them all to DVD. Is there a way to move them so that I could place them on a thumb drive or an external hard drive? I can't figure out how to do that. And it would even be great if I could buy a program, and this would be the second stage of my question, that would allow me to take the commercials out and watch it.
That would be wonderful, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. In terms of the memory that you're using, yes, running Windows Vista with 4 gigabytes of RAM is pretty much optimum. That is, of course, not where all of your television programs are being stored. They're being stored internally on the hard drive. And so the question is, then, can you move them off of the internal hard drive where you probably have a lot of space, but nonetheless it can fill up with enough video? And there are a couple of ways. Perhaps one of the simplest things you might want to consider, for very little money, relatively speaking, well under $100, you can get an external hard drive that just plugs into a USB or a FireWire port in the computer that can store a terabyte, 1,000 gigabytes of information, and just use that as storage for the archival TV programs that you don't want to keep active on the machine. Although when they are on that external hard drive, and Western Digital makes a line called My Book that you'll see a lot of different places, then they really are just as accessible. A lot of people use those for backups since they are so affordable, and it's so much easier to do that than trying to burn them, as you say, to DVD. I'm unaware of any software, although there may be some out there that tries to identify commercials and pulls them out. There are some playback software, and I don't know, I don't use Media Player very much, only when I need to, because I generally don't have the time to deal with it. But certainly many programs will allow you to immediately, when you see a commercial coming along, immediately skip 60 seconds or 90 seconds or 2 minutes, so that it's almost as if it's skipping them automatically. But the advertisers and the broadcasters highly resist placing any identifying tags into the broadcast stream so that you could automate the process of skipping their commercials.
Is that difficult then for also for you know, the types of formats of video? Is it possible all the time that you'd be able to save and replay stuff on your own external hard drive as opposed to going back to their website?
Well, that is, again, an issue. There are some formats and some websites, depending on how you were downloading this and where you were getting it from, that put various kinds of restrictions, content management systems.
I'm thinking of stuff like iTunes.
Like iTunes, yeah. Which is perhaps the extreme example of controlling, although they've actually loosened up lately,
right.
Of controlling how and when and where you can play it. But in the case of downloading, unless the software is only going to stream it to you live so that you can't even save it to disk, and there are, if you do a search for that, a number of software programs, perhaps not all officially sanctioned by Microsoft, that will capture those streams. Uh-huh. So even if it's playing, you're capturing it. Perhaps it's unauthorized, but you are capturing it, and once
into
it's
a
on the hard drive.
Format.
And so it's an issue where the rules are changing fairly quickly, and more sites, both for audio and I suppose for video as well, are deciding that the content management, the restrictions just aren't worth it. It's sort of like a repeat of the days when all the movie theaters and studios were convinced that videotaping was going to put them out of business.
Right, right. And so you go to a site like Hulu.com or something like that.
Yes.
You can go there and you pay the price for that show, but that file doesn't necessarily become yours, or is that yours?
Officially,
you can copy it as much as you want,
it varies from site to site, but yeah. Officially, many of them, you're just renting this, and if
right.
In the worst case, if you stop subscribing, you no longer have access to what you'd already paid for.
All right. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455 with your computer questions for Peter Kimball, and again, caller on line one. Good morning. Good afternoon, rather.
Good afternoon. I was actually, this may not be your area of expertise, but I was interested in software that actually would allow you to convert old cassette tapes into digital.
Well, there's a two-step process in doing that. And the first is, of course, you have to have a cassette player to play them, because we'll assume that you've got that. That will have audio out, and instead of plugging it into most cassette players, except the simple little portable ones, will have line level out. That means they'll have a jack that you would plug into a stereo system or that you would plug into some other device, such as an amplifier. That can then be plugged directly into the what's called the line in port. It's the place on an audio card, which almost every computer will have, not for the headphones, but to send an audio signal into it from some external source. And the audio card or the device doesn't care whether it's coming from a cassette, whether it's coming from a turntable. A lot of turntables are set up in systems to do that now, to get old vinyl LPs digitized. So that's a fairly simple thing to do, given that you've got an actual cassette player that will allow you to plug in a standard audio cable into it and the other end into your computer system. The software, there are a lot of different software packages that can take that information, and once you're bringing this in, it can be saved digitally. It's converted into a digital format. Probably some of the software that just comes with the, if you've got a CD or a DVD player, it's very much like ripping information, ripping, as it's called, tracks from a CD, except you're getting it from this audio input. Some of the software will go further and will try to help you eliminate some of the extra hiss and noise that are inherent in some of those media. Just like for turntables, there is software available that's getting better now that will try to reduce, if not eliminate, some of the clicks and pops and ticks that you get from old vinyl recordings.
So it's just a matter, so it's finding the appropriate software that will let you do that.
Yes, and that will be very easy. There, a lot of it is shareware, and again, I'm just going to suggest if you just type something like cassette tape, to CD or cassette to MP3. I've just started typing the word cassette here on Google, and I've got, you know, do I want to go cassette tape to CD? Do I want to do a cassette to digital, cassette to MP3? All kinds of links and software, and some of them I would check the software that that came with your computer system. Oftentimes the CD drive itself will have, if you want to take it to a CD format, we'll have software that will capture incoming audio, such as you've plugged in to the audio card, since almost every computer now has an audio card and a CD recorder.
So that line in you're talking about, it's on the audio card, is it normally where you plug a microphone in?
No, there are generally two. And you'll generally have a place to plug in a microphone, mm-hmm. a place to plug in speakers,
right.
maybe a separate place to plug in headphones, mm-hmm. And what's called a line in. And the difference between that and the microphone in is the line in assumes the signal is coming in at a higher level,
right.
While the microphone needs more of a boost.
And most computers have this line in.
Most computers have them. Okay. They're typically at least three different little jacks, the green for the speakers, and I don't remember, there was a pink one and a black one and a mm-hmm. red one and a yellow one, and who knows.
And they ran out of colors.
Yes. Then,
there you go. But good luck on that.
Okay. Well, thank
you very much. A lot of people are doing that, so you'll find lots of software options out there, and much of it is free or shareware.
All right. Thanks for your call. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, and I believe line two is the next caller, so let's go there. Good afternoon, line two.
Hi, I got a question about the speed of my internet connection. I've got Comcast at home with a cable modem.
Yes.
And it has been fine. The last few weeks, it's gotten really slow browsing and downloading. And I don't know if it's because all the students have come back and they're clogging up the lines.
Could be your neighbors.
Something else.
Well, it certainly can be that. One question is, do you notice, is it noticeably worse some times of the day than others?
I don't use it during the day. I just use it in the evening, so I haven't been able to test it out that much.
Well, the most common answer to your question is yes. Cable modems and cable service is shared media, so on your particular branch or your node, there are going to be perhaps as many as a couple of hundred other users, most of whom aren't doing much at any particular time. But if you happen to be in an area, especially if the population here in Champaign-Urbana, the student population bumps up in some neighborhoods quite a bit, and most of their time downloading videos and all sorts of other high bandwidth applications will definitely cut down the amount of time you have available on your system. The best test for that is get up sometime, it may be hard to do, but nonetheless, like on a Saturday morning, about 9 o'clock in the morning, and a lot of those folks who are doing all of that downloading aren't doing it then, and see if there's a noticeable difference. If there is, then you can be pretty sure that the problem is not with your system and not with your modem. It is just the high number of users. You can try. It doesn't always help, but you can try calling the Comcast technical support number and saying, I think we've got too many users on this node. Things are really slow. Can you see if there's any possibility of putting in a request for a work order eventually to split your node into a couple, which they occasionally have to do.
Yeah, I've called Comcast help before just generally, and they're not too helpful. But if I specifically request that they split the node, they might do that?
Well, they will. If you specifically request, they won't do that if you ask them. But if you call them and say, I'm getting incredibly slow response, especially at peak usage times, I think there might be far too much traffic on this node. Is there any possibility you can look into that? A user can't request that, and they'll generally say, oh, our engineering staff is, you know, on top of that sort of thing. But I would it certainly doesn't hurt to bring it to their attention.
Okay. And since the neighborhood I live in, I don't think, has a lot of students in it anyway, the fact that students are flocking across town, that's probably not going to affect my cable modem traffic.
Not as much, although all of that goes together into one very large pipeline that Comcast has out of Champaign-Urbana. So it really depends on their capacity. And they and AT&T for the DSL lines and all internet service providers these days have to keep ramping up the amount of bandwidth they have. And so the bottleneck could be any place. And I assume you're finding this slow down whatever sites you may be going to.
Yeah, that's correct. Sometimes I can't even get on at all. Just going to Google or a really basic place just hangs for 5 minutes or so.
Well, that does seem excessive. Are you connecting wirelessly?
No.
Because that's another possibility with conflicts. But if you're not connecting wirelessly, we can eliminate that as a possibility.
Well, I'll try what you suggested and try it out at different times just to see if it's consistent or not, and then I'll call Comcast.
Yes, that'll...
Can you get any usable information off, like, the broadband report sites? I know that there are some places online that offer, you know, people check in and report and say how much... they're getting, and I can test your broadband connection too?
You can test it. It will tell you in many cases, and in the case of the listener, it'll tell him pretty much what he already knows.
Okay.
You've got kind of slow service. Some of them will actually try to categorize your usage compared to others in your general IP domain areas, but I've never seen any that you can reliably say, you know, I've seen none that can actually test your particular node. They don't have enough people trying it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Good luck.
And thanks for your call.
That's a tough thing to do.
It is. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. On we go to line three. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello. I'm thinking about getting a netbook, and I was wondering, well, first I have two questions. First, about the advantages of getting a netbook with a solid-state flash drive versus a hard drive. You know, is it true that I'll get a better battery life that way, and also just less danger of, you know, bumping the hard drive and, you know, messing things up that way? Do you think it's better to get a solid-state flash drive with that? And also, I have a 9-year-old computer, which really takes care of everything I need to do right now, you know, except for an internet connection. It does not have a wireless card. Would I be able to, is there some way I could hook up the old computer to the netbook and, you know, download like driver updates and things like that from my old computer via the netbook?
Okay, well, let's look at the first question.
Okay.
Certainly, you're going to have lower battery consumption. The battery will last longer with the solid-state hard drive. The
uh-huh.
solid-state hard drive is much faster, on the order of hundreds of times faster, because it has no mechanical moving parts. The downside is that it is going to be more expensive for a given amount of storage, and you can actually get more storage current technology with a miniature hard drive than is
uh-huh.
affordable with the solid-state memory. But if you're not planning on having large files, hundreds of photos or videos or things on the netbook, that shouldn't really matter. So it's a matter of, I think, mostly cost that you have to look at.
Okay.
And if money is no object, get the largest amount of solid-state memory that you can, which
mm-hmm.
should be fine. The older machine is a desktop machine or a laptop? I missed that.
Oh, Just a laptop.
Okay. It's almost certainly can be connected. There, it has, even if it's up to 8 or 9 years old, probably has the standard PC card slot, these days called a PCMCIA card, and don't ask me what that acronym is, but that's often what they're called. And there are both internet adapters, if you wanted to cable it, or wireless adapters that you could plug in there. What is the operating system that you're running on this older laptop?
Oh, it actually is Windows XP.
Okay, so there are certainly a lot of, you would be able to still, almost any device that you would get, any plug-in card, that could either be as a standard network, Ethernet, hardwired cable, or as a wireless card, will have the appropriate drivers for Windows XP. So the answer is yes, you can do that, and then you could connect it with your netbook in a couple of ways, what's called a peer-to-peer connection, where you just cable one to the other, or if you're planning on having, for example, wireless access with the netbook from around the home, and you have a wireless router, essentially what's called a wireless access point from Netgear or Linksys or some Cisco or some such company, you can actually have both of the computers be registered on that and transfer from one to the other once you set the permissions appropriately. So it's a fairly straightforward thing to do. A lot of people do it. You will simply need to make sure that you have the appropriate network card for the older laptop.
Yeah. The problem with that, well, it's a Dell, and I tried to see if I could get a network card for it, and they don't even list that model anymore. They start with the model after it, and I looked someplace online, and it seems like, you know, it's just prohibitively expensive to get any kind of network card for the older laptop.
Well, you certainly don't need a Dell brand. Any brand will do, assuming that the Dell, which it almost certainly does, although I don't know the particular model or have that information available, but if it has the standard PC card slot, which it almost certainly does.
Oh, yeah, it then, does.
Then any standard. Now, there is a new configuration recently for the kinds of cards. They're kind of L-shaped on the connectors that go in, but there are still millions of machines out there with the older connections, such as you've got the older slots, the standard PC slots, and there should be laptop wireless cards available for, oh, I haven't priced them lately because so many come with it built in, but certainly well under $100 and probably under $50.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for, if that answered your question, thanks for your call. And we have time, I think, for one more question.
Okay.
Just to clarify, netbooks today, the hard drives that are the storage on those machines are generally, are they still the old, the mechanical hard drives, or are they
solid
state?
Some of them are, because the everybody keeps saying that hard drives are on their way out, and they probably are because they have moving parts,
right.
But they are getting so dense, so much information in such small space that it is still the most cost-effective way of doing it. And they take very little power, and many of them are packaged in such a way that they're fairly resistant. If you drop the machine, as long as it's not in the process of writing at the time, you're likely to break other things in the machine rather than the hard drive.
So even on a netbook with that tiny little amount of space,
they
can put a lot of, a decent amount at least of storage.
Yeah, they have little tiny form factors, like inch and a half form factors.
All right. One more call. Let's go to line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just have a question about PDAs. And I know they're pretty much on the way out because smartphones now pretty much rule the world. But I need to at least find out a way to take my data from a Palm PDA in particular to get it to a user-friendly way, either in Outlook or in some other even internet service that then has all my calendaring and everything that then I could eventually upload to a smartphone, because I'm not there yet.
Well, you're beyond my area of expertise here with the PDAs, so I'm going to give you the generic advice that will almost certainly work. I know that this can be done because people have been doing it, and people have told me about it, and I say, that's great. I'm glad you're able to. The web is going to be your friend in this.
Okay.
Do a search for that particular Palm. Do a search for transfer Palm to, smartphone or to whatever phone you want to do, or simply transfer it, transfer Palm data to PC or to Outlook, and you'll probably find dozens, if not hundreds or thousands, of sites. And on that first page, you'll probably find several that will be very close. You may have to refine your search a couple of times, but it's certainly doable, and it's been done before, and you'll just have to search out the details a little bit.
Okay, so there's no one program that maybe works the best. It's all just going to vary.
Well, there may be, but I'm unaware of what it might be.
Okay. I would assume that if you move between hardware of the same brand, you'd probably get a fairly helpful
right.
Online or on the phone support for that. So if you had a Palm PDA and bought a Palm phone, then they'd be more than happy to figure it out.
But if you're switching, they've told me that.
Yes, of course.
Because they want me to buy another.
They want
one
you to stay with the
products.
Company, sure.
Yeah, but it's actually getting to the point where the Palm stuff. It's not as universal anymore, and I don't know if it really was ever, but to be able to, look at it online in a lot of different formats and stuff like that, it's seeming to kind of go the wayside.
Well, and what you may end up having to do is a two-stage transfer from Palm to kind of a universal PC accessible format, and then from that to whatever particular device you want to go to. Going from a Palm to a particular other device may be more than you're going to find available in one convenient software package, but making an intermediate stop on a PC or some such would be useful.
All right. Thanks for your call this afternoon. And that is going to pretty much wrap it up for the show today. But one other question I want to bring, because we've looked at Google so many times. We've been trying to find stuff that, as we've been talking, Google's been our friend. But then again, Bing has been your friend, too.
Any
difference between the two that people are going to notice?
Well, other than the obvious interface differences, both are doing a fairly good job. Microsoft is promoting Bing as being able to filter out much of the information that is irrelevant to you, and it seems to be doing a fairly good job. I'm glad to see that that Bing is starting to make more of a presence, because its presence felt more, because that is going to lead to improvements on both products.
Right.
But as the advertisements go, how useful is it to be able to have 279,000 hits to your question? You really just want one that answers the question specifically.
They haven't gotten the technology down where they can only get that one answer.
Neither there yet, but it has certainly, if you're having trouble finding something with one of them, try the other one.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks a lot for stopping by again, Peter, and we'll talk to you next month.
Well, I think I'll be back in November.
Oh.
I'm alternating months now, but okay. You'll have the computers and you will be here next month, and I'll be back a little bit before Thanksgiving.
And we'll look forward to hearing you then.
Yes.
That's Peter Kimball, who is the lead faculty trainer for the Center for Teaching Excellence on the U of I campus. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, and we have the settlement prices in from the boards of trade, right now we switch it to AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at those numbers as they finished up in Chicago on this afternoon. Thanks, Tom. Numbers like this in the wheat pit for the day. Nearby contracts settled at 4.57 1/4. Actually, that was the previous day, and the wheat December contract at 4.56 on its settlement was down 1¢ 1/4, with a high of 4.63, a low at 4.52 3/4. Once again, a 4.56 settlement price, down 1 1/4 on the afternoon. And then the March, 4.82 1/4, the high, the low at 72, settlement price at 4.75 3/4, down 1¢. And the May futures, 4.95, the high, the low at 4.85 1/4, settled at 4.88 1/4, down 1 1/4 for the afternoon. July futures for the day finished up like this. Nearby was down 2 cents. This is actually next year's contract, to 5.06 top, bottom at 4.95 1/4. Settlement price for the new crop wheat, July at 4.99 1/2. Down 2 cents on the afternoon. And December futures in the soft red, 5.43 1/4 the high, the low at 5.35 1/4, and settlement price at 5.37, down 2 cents. In Kansas City, the nearby contract there finished 3 lower, a $4.69 settlement price, with a high of 77 1/4 and a low at 67 1/2. December hard red winter wheat at $4.69. Down 3 cents on the afternoon. From the corn pit back in Chicago, 3.17 1/2, the high, the low at 3.10, settled at 3.16, down 2 cents. The March at 3.30 3/4 high, low at 3.23 1/2, settled at 3.29 1/4, down 2 1/4. In the May futures, 3.40 the high, the low at 33 1/4, Settlement price at $3.38.5, down 2 cents. July contract, $3.48.5. The high, the low at $41.5. A settlement price at $3.47, down 2. And September corn, $3.56.25. The high, the low at $3.50. Settlement price there at $3.55.75, down 1.5. Next year's December, this is the new crop, $3.67. The high, the low at $3.60. Settlement price at $3.66. December 2010 contract in the corn pit, down a penny and 1/4. December oat futures, $2.12.5. The high for the day, the low at $2.07. Settlement price at $2.12. Down a penny on the afternoon. And November beans now, $9.39.75. The high, the low at $9.09.25, settlement price at $9.13.5, down 27.5 cents. The next contract is January at $9.42.5 on the high, the low at $15, settlement price at $9.19, down 26.25. March futures $9.43, the high, the low at $9.19.25, settled $9.22.25, down 24.25. And the May futures in the soybean pit, $9.38.5, the high, the low at $9.20, settlement price at $9.23, down 20.75 on the afternoon. July futures, 18 cents lower, $9.41 the high, the low at $23.25, settlement price at $9.26.5, down 18. And next year's November beans, $9.03.75 the high, the low at $9.89, settlement price at $8.96.5, down 7.5. Let me give you that November low again. It was not $9.89, but rather $8.89. October bean meal now, $290 the high, the low at $281.50, settled $281.90, down $8.10. December futures there down $8.60 at $276.20. October soybean oil, $34.79 the high, the low at $34.78, settlement price at $33.77, down 91 for the day. And December futures were down 91 as well. They finished up at 34.19. Over on the CME Group's livestock side, nearby October live cattle futures, an 85.77.5 top. Bottom there at 84.70. Settlement price at 84.97.5, down 57.5. December futures, 84.95 the high. Low at $84 and a nickel. Settled 84.52.5, down 37.5. February contract, 85.85 the high. The low at 85.12.5. Settlement price at 85.32.5, 40 cents lower. And April futures, 88.12.5, the high, the low at 87.55. Settlement price on the afternoon, 87.82.5, 17.5 cents lower. September feeder cattle for the day, down a dime, 97.35, the high, the low at $97.05. Settled 97.15, 10 cents lower. October feeders, 97.25, the high, the low at 96.55. Settlement price at 96.72.5. Down 30 cents in November feeder cattle, 97.60 the high, the low at 96.62.5. Settlement price, 96.70, down 72.5 cents. January futures, 98.45 the high, the low at 97.65. Settlement price at 97.82.5, 72.5 cents lower. October contract now, 65 cents lower in the lean hogs, $50.80 the high, the low at $40, or rather $49.90. Settlement price at $50.15, down 65. December futures, $49.80 the high, the low at $49.02.5. Settlement price at $49.37.5, 92.5 cents lower. In the February lean hogs, $56.55 for the high. The low was at $55.65, and a settlement price at $55.95, down 97.5 cents. April lean hog futures, $62.35 the high. The low there at $61.20, settlement price at $61.27.5, $1.67.5 lower. And the frozen pork bellies, $2 lower, down the limit at $82.60, and the Febs, the March at $81.52.5. They finished down $1.80.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
You are listening to the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up this afternoon during the closing market report, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's out of Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And then later in the program, we'll discuss the agricultural cash grain markets with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. That all comes up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. Speaking of which, we're coming up on the top of the hour. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers.